Welcome to RFN episode 353. I am your host, James Jones, and with me this week, John Lindemann.
Hey, James, I got to say, Johnny, he's old news. It's a pleasure to be here with you, buddy.
Oh, thank you, John. Also with me this week, Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
I, for one, would like to welcome our new RFN overlord.
And joining us this week as, you know, in a weird position of not hosting, the doctor is back, Jonathan Metz.
Hey, everybody. I'm still kind of getting the water out of my ears, but it's good to be back. And I actually want to say you guys did an awesome job while I was gone. I really appreciate it. I'm still not back up to full speed, and that's why I asked James to host again this week, just to kind of give me a transitional period. But I really missed being on the show. I hated missing Greg twice, actually, in the span of 3 weeks. That really sucked. And Evan, too, who I haven't talked to in a long time, but it really made me feel really good that you guys continued to do the show and that you were able to put together the audio that I saved. And anyway, I'll probably talk a little bit more about what happened later, but for now, I'm just glad to be back talking about video games with my friends.
It's good to have you back, Johnny. It took a lot to heal the hole. We're glad to have you back.
Heal the hole.
Yeah.
It's a lovely phrase.
Think about that, gentlemen. Think about that for your long and dark nights. All right, but we kick the show off with a disaster, followed by new business. And since I have the authority to do it, I'm giving myself new business to start the show off. Because I actually have, for the first time in a long time, a game that's not on the PS3. It's a Wii U game. It's called Wonderful 101.
Hey!
Awesome.
I wasn't intending to buy this game right out of the gate.
You don't buy much of anything right out of the gate.
No, it's not really my wheelhouse, but I took advantage of Target's Please Save the Wii U fundraiser when they had their two games for the price of three deal going on. So,
but only if you brought a can of food for the local shelter.
Yeah, the local Wii U shelter.
And participated in the bake sale.
So I went ahead and I got that, and I started playing it. I'm about three-ish hours in at this point, so not too deep into the game, but... Mm-hmm. You know, it's so far it's super weird, which I appreciate because I enjoy that kind of stuff. Obviously, the combat system is taking some getting used to. It is complicated, but not in the kind of ways that, you know, character action games have complicated combat systems. It feels like it's its own thing, and it's kind of hard to describe it. Somebody described the game, said most character action games, which is a lot of the stuff that Platinum makes, are about mob management, where you're one character managing the mob of enemies coming your way, whereas in Wonderful 101, you are the mob and you're trying to manage yourself, which I thought was kind of a good analogy for the game, because a lot of the game is really just spent trying to marshal what is essentially this disorganized mass of people going to a really bad costume party.
So have we reached the point in the conversation about Wonderful 101 where it's okay to return to comparing it to Pikmin? Because that sounds a lot like what you do in Pikmin. I know it's a lot faster paced in Wonderful 101.
I never understood the reticence to comparing it to Pikmin, not just because Nintendo felt that these two games needed to come out so close to one another, but just because there is a certain, I mean, there's a certain even visual quality to them that's reminiscent of one another.
Well, that's almost the only thing. Like, there's not, in terms of gameplay.
I disagree, because you spend a lot of the time you are trying to increase the size of your mass of forces by pretty much literally harvesting them with what essentially amounts to a whistle. Or in the case of the Wonderful 101, the Wonderful Chain, I guess is what they call it, Wonderful Line.
Mm-hmm. The Wonder Line.
Yeah, you're basically drawing a line around these wild, what essentially are the Pikmin version of civilians, and pulling them into your army. I mean, there are real similarities. They don't play the same, but there's real, you know, upper level, like just describing the action that is similar. I mean,
well, I know when I played the second demo at E3 this year, I was really struggling to keep all of my people together because whenever you got hit, they would kind of go flying and splattering across the stage, which happens all the time in Pikmin also. And I felt like I was spending more time running around trying to recollect everybody than I was actually fighting the battle, which I think is an incentive to play more defensively and to dodge and to block better, clearly.
Yeah, but you've got more moves definitely in Wonderful 101 than you do.
Oh yeah,
in Pikmin.
Definitely. I mean, from a gameplay standpoint, the games really aren't that similar, but you're doing a lot of the same verbs. And verbs that are very distinct to those games that you don't normally.
Recruiting, collecting, grouping, herding.
They're not normally things you do in a game, you know, in a console action game.
Yeah.
So there's a certain similarity in just the terms you would use to describe the gameplay, even if the action for doing it is dramatically different. Puzzle solving, using your mob, that's a big part of both of those games. And, you know, there are a lot of these weird similarities that, although they're very fundamentally different games, they're both sort of different takes on the same genre. The same take on different genres, is what I'm trying to say. They're both sort of flipping the script, one on the sort of the real-time strategy, although we've had that debate before for Pikmin. And like I said, the other one, it still plays a bit like a character action game, but it's this very weird take on it. And it's interesting to see how both those games sort of evolved differently from what is essentially a relatively set genre. Now, to the point of Wonderful 101, I do really enjoy the aesthetic. Like I said, the combat system is still baffling me a little bit. I remembered from the demo I played how incredibly useful the blocking move was, so I bought it right away and had it pretty much from the first real level on. So it's been sort of a... you could do it, and you should do it, but if you don't know to do it, I can imagine that level, the first few levels, are incredibly frustrating.
So is the blocking move the one that makes you look like a Jell-O mold?
It is.
Yeah, it is. And it's really designed so that it's the first thing you buy. Like,
yeah, it's 10 points.
That and the dodge move are the only things you can afford after the first chapter.
Right.
So.
But if you don't recognize how good they are and know that you should be using them as much as they need to be used, those levels would be really frustrating.
Yeah, so there's no guide to indicate that, hey, this is a good idea.
No, there's nothing to even tell you should buy them. I mean,
no.
It doesn't
except
even tell
for
you
the
to,
fact that they're cheap.
It doesn't even tell you to go into the shop. It just says you can if you want. Whereas a lot of games like that will walk you through your first purchase in the shop. It's just like, you want to go to the shop, whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, these points you're collecting, you can use them in the shop. But it does that at the start of the level. And then it's like, if you go in there and buy them, good for you. If not, well. Like, there's bosses in the first level that the Jell-O mold thing really is, like, super important to know how to use against them. Because they spit fucking bombs. But, like, it's really the kind of game where I'm having to sort of grow through playing it. Thankfully, right now, the punishment for dying isn't that bad. So, as I'm figuring the stuff out, I'm willing to sort of just screw around with it and see what happens.
Yeah, I thought that playing the demo beforehand really helped me because I haven't died all that much and I'm playing on normal.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's almost like I kind of forget that there are items that you can use to gain back health or to attack the enemies. And it's just like there's never really any need for it.
I will say the item system is not good. If you do need them, it's bad. It's on the gamepad, unless you're using the gamepad, then it's not on the gamepad. So basically, it's wherever you're not looking, and then to use it, you have to either tap it on the gamepad and hold your finger there for a while. So
you can use left and right on
yeah,
the D-pad.
And the D-pad, but you have to hold down for a while again. It's not touch it and it uses it. So what was funny is like it makes a noise when you first touch it. So I thought I was being healed. And I'm like, God, these items don't do anything. And then I realized, I have to hold it. Okay, I'm gonna sit here and do this. I'm a bit pleasantly surprised by the number of secrets I'm finding in levels. I'm kind of a completionist in that way, so like when I see something and I can't figure out how to get there, it's incredibly frustrating. And some of the things, like I said, maybe there's like some civilians on a roof I can't figure out how to get to.
Yeah, well, that will keep driving you crazy because you just don't have the tools yet to save some of these people.
I gotcha.
There are some secret passages that perhaps you didn't find. Like, it's really not obvious that, say, like, you're crossing a bridge, you're supposed to fall off of it and go into water and find some secret spot.
Yeah, I did that. And in fact, it happens in the very first real level.
Yeah. But there are also secrets that you need the hammer for, and you know, the hammer you don't get until very late in the game.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, there's been some interesting experiences so far in the game. Like I said, I'm still sort of adapting to it. It's a bit of a transition from what I have been playing, so I'm sort of shifting gears. I'll probably have a lot more detailed thoughts next week after I've had, you know, maybe 10, 15 hours with it at that point. So I'll pick up on that from there. And real quick, I just wanted to close out, even though I was going to do it last week, I want to close out Valkyria Chronicles by discussion of DLC. So I'm always really interested in how games implement DLC, because I'm not inherently of the mind that DLC is the biggest scam on earth. I do feel like if a game drops day one DLC, it feels a little bit sketchy sometimes.
Yeah.
This game is old enough that, I mean, this was kind of in the pioneering days of DLC, I would imagine.
So I was curious how it handles it. You know, I came from Fire Emblem, which handles it really, really well. You buy a pack of DLC for like $5 and you get 3 levels. And that's pretty good. Or you could buy them individually if you want. And so I went and tried it out, and I said, all right, I'll pay for these, what are described as these sort of self-contained stories that with, you know, full voice acting, and they sort of tell the side story of characters you meet in the game. So there's 2 DLC packs for Edie, which shouldn't surprise me at all, because she has white hair, pigtails, blue eyes, and she's a sadist. So she's probably Japan's favorite character. And there's a DLC pack for Sylvaria, who's one of the main enemies in the game. So I went and bought the first Edie DLC pack, because why not? And what it is there's a battle. She and some of the more colorful characters from the main game's party got separated. And they sort of give you a hint where it is in the story, but it's a side story. And they basically have to fight their way back to the unit. And then they get distracted and have to fight an enemy unit, and just have to survive for 3 turns. That's basically the mission. And, you know, I played through it, beat it in about an hour-ish, and then it just ends. And as much as I enjoyed watching the sadomasochistic relationship between Edie and Homer, and the incredibly gay Bender, which there is a character in this game that is offensively flaming homosexual as voiced by the voice actor for Bender from Futurama. It's bad. It's one of his personal skills is likes men, and he gains strength when he's positioned near men.
Oh my god.
And he's constantly talking about getting back to Papa, which is another one of the men in his unit.
You know, I'm all for gay characters being represented in video games, but that may not be the best way to
do it. No, it's bad. Yeah, exactly. It's bad. Yeah. Like that whole unit.
It's not exactly pushing anything forward.
Every character in that
unit, you know what I mean,
in this like sub part of your main army is broke as fuck. Like it's almost a glorifying train wreck to watch how broken they are.
Did you end up using Vice very much from Skies of Arcadia?
I used them all the time because I love that game. I used Vice and I used Ika, and I didn't want to use her, but occasionally you have to use the healer who is. Oh god, I'm blanking on her name now. The other female character in Skies of Arcadia.
Oh, okay. I didn't know there was more than one.
Yeah, there's Ice Vika, and then there is the White Mage healer role.
You know, the fact that Vice is also in Sonic and Sega All-Stars Racing, it is kind of cool that they're keeping that character alive, and you know, maybe gives you some false hope that they might give him his own game once more, but
I love that game, those characters. Vice is an amazing, just ridiculous character.
Yeah.
Ika is bombastic and absurdist. Fina, that's it. And Fina is just sort of like your stereotypical, demure, ancient culture JRPG character that occasionally they just completely just screw around with. Like, they make her dress like a pirate, as she would perceive pirates to dress. So you get these scenes of just ridiculousness.
I think it's very dangerous to try to predict anything that Sega will do other than release another Sonic game.
Other than bankruptcy.
I don't know. They just dropped, you know, several million dollars on Atlas, so apparently they have some cash.
Bankruptcy on bankruptcy. Let's just stack them up.
But, you know, they did release a couple of sequels to Valkyria Chronicles on PSP.
They did.
I think only the second game came out in America. I think the third one is Japan only still, or maybe it came out in Europe. But those did pretty well, at least in Japan, and maybe that kind of points to a strategy they might eventually take on bringing back Skies of Arcadia, because that franchise
on PSP
or Vita probably more likely, but you know, that would be a fantastic place. And they've got that. Didn't they announce a Phantasy Star Online game for Vita?
So, yeah, port. It's a port of episodes 1 and 2, I believe.
Okay, there seems to be some interest in at least doing RPGs for handhelds in Japan, and you know, maybe they'll eventually get around to that franchise.
It's an absolutely. I mean, for me, that game is amazing, and I loved having those characters in there. And it also helps that Vice and Ika are both top tiers in their class. So, like, they were really super useful. But, yeah, to the point of the DLC, which they don't appear in because it's these really broke-ass characters in this game, I was pleased with the chapter, and then I realized that was it. And it was $3. I got about an hour out of it. But there's a certain sense of, oh, okay, I guess that's it then. All right. Like, they kind of got you engaged with, all right, these idiots have somehow managed to get separated from the main unit. Now they're pretty much fucked because they're a bunch of morons. And you're kind of like, I want to see how bad this gets. And it's like, no, you don't get to see the end of this train wreck. We're cutting this DLC off here. So, you know, it was a good attempt. I mean, the map is a reused map, although all the voice acting, all the story bits, all the narrative, that's all new. It's new content. So, you know, I give it, you know, a good try, but it's just, I don't feel compelled to buy the other two DLC. Which is a shame, because I almost bought all the Fire Emblem DLC where I said, no, you need to stop.
Control yourself.
Yep. So I'm going to go ahead and throw the microphone over to Johnny.
Okay. Well, I have to admit, I feel kind of guilty going before John, because I think he has something much more interesting and profound to talk about than I do. So, in the flood, I lost all my Nintendo consoles. I still have some of my games, obviously, that are on disc that I was able to get out. All my digital stuff is gone, and time will tell whether I ever get to recover that stuff. Certainly, I lost my save files, if nothing else. Anyway, for now, I am Nintendo-less and am investigating options to get a Wii U and 3DS very soon. With some help from staff members, I should say, and I really appreciate their generosity with that. But I don't have it yet, so I've been playing other stuff in the meantime. You guys might know I was in Europe a couple weeks ago, and that's a part of the longer story that I might get into later. But anyway, so I was traveling a lot. I haven't had a TV a lot of the time. Since all that stuff went on. So I've been playing a lot of handheld stuff. And I did also, I lost my desktop computer, so I replaced it with a Surface Pro, which is a computer that Microsoft makes that I've been interested in for a while. So it's basically a tablet that's also a laptop. And the great thing, and it runs real Windows 8, which means you can install stuff like Steam on it and play computer games on it, even though it looks like a tablet. And so I travel with that, and I got to play a few things on it, and also had my Vita. That was the one gaming system that I managed to get out of there, just because I actually pulled out the 3DS also, but the 3DS apparently got too wet and did not survive. The Vita was okay. But anyway, so the games I played, three of them I want to talk about briefly, really because none of them are super interesting on their own, but they all sort of relate to Nintendo games in ways that I thought people might find interesting. So I'll start with Binding of Isaac, because that game is coming pretty soon, I want to say, to 3DS. Maybe like early next year. It's going to be published by Nicolas. And
are you sure about that, though? Because I thought that they had the idea of putting it on 3DS, but then Nintendo said, no, there's no, like, we tried, but there's no way that we can, you know, put this content on our system.
I really can't imagine why not.
Because of the theme.
It's
abortion,
it's a rated M game.
Yeah, but I don't know. Apparently Nintendo's being really sensitive. So how recently did you, because I think that they kind of scrapped the idea.
Oh, really? I hadn't heard
I have a September 4th headline that says it was banned from 3DS for breaking Nintendo's religion rule.
That is really a shame. And
according to IGN, Nintendo of America's head of business development, Dan Adelman, told them that, quote, it kind of kills me. It kills me right now that I had to make that phone call. we carve out some categories of content that we don't allow. Religious themes is one of those topics, and so it was deemed to be in violation of that.
That's a real shame, because Binding of Isaac is not really about religion from what I've played of it, and I've played it for 3 or 4 hours at least, and I've seen a good bit of the game. I mean, clearly the name, the title of the game comes from religion, but you know, you could probably say that for all kinds of games that have appeared on Nintendo systems. I would say the themes of the game are mostly like psychotraumatic, and they're disturbing, and it's definitely a rated M game, and it, you know, I mean, it deals with abortion in the sense that like one of the items you can get is a coat hanger, but it doesn't tell you what that means.
That's probably enough to trip the,
hey, yeah. I mean, there's some brutal shit in the game, but it doesn't show abortion. It doesn't talk about anything like that. There's a lot of stuff that's implied, and I think that's a clever way to get around exactly the kind of rule that we're talking about here. You know, they're not explicit about anything in particular. The story is very implied. It's very abstract. As far as I can tell, it seems to be about a kid who doesn't feel loved by his mother and has maybe some memories or maybe some just nightmares, maybe things that didn't actually happen. Some of them, I don't know, but he's dealing with all of this, and the whole game really seems to be like his nightmare that he's trying to get out of. And so you see these flashes of items or people or ideas or emotions that seem to be part of a very tortured childhood, you know, a very unhappy childhood. But you know, the game is about like a baby running around shooting tears at monsters. I mean, it's not really that controversial, I don't think. It's dealing with some adult themes, and it's doing it through an avatar of a child. But I don't know. I haven't seen anything that I thought was like super shocking or that I hadn't seen in other games. So I'm kind of surprised to hear that. But anyway, the reason I brought it up and the reason that I thought Nintendo fans would find it interesting is because the entire game takes place in what are essentially randomly generated dungeons from The Legend of Zelda 1. Zelda 1. And yes, they are randomly generated, which is occasionally unfortunate. Although I have to say, like, if you've ever gone back and really played the first Legend of Zelda, there are even pieces of the dungeons in that game that feel like they could have been randomly generated.
Oh yeah, there's some mm-hmm. there's some just terribleness.
There's a lot of dead ends and like weird warp points that don't really serve any purpose. They kind of link very mundane areas of the dungeon. You know, there are block puzzles that just don't really make a lot of sense. There are rooms where you go in and there's a bunch of enemies and you kill them and like a blue rupee worth $5 pops out and you're like, oh great, yay. I almost died in this room and you gave me something that's practically useless. And then you go back out. You know, and there's also places, especially in the Master Quest, where you're like walking through walls that are unmarked, or you know, there are places where you can bomb the walls, but the only way you would ever know that is to just kind of guess, because it doesn't really, there's no indication whatsoever. So there's stuff like that in Binding of Isaac. I mean, it is very, very heavily inspired by The Legend of Zelda. But the gameplay, instead of running around with a sword, you have a projectile weapon. So they start out as your tears, and so you basically, on the computer, you play with the arrow keys and also WASD. So basically you can move in one direction and shoot in any other direction at the same time. So it's more like Robotron controls, or, I mean, you could do it with dual joysticks, but I think it's meant to be played more on digital controls and not analog. I know that it's made by the guys who made Super Meat Boy. And I believe in the beginning, at least, they were kind of opposed to the idea of people playing this on joysticks. They didn't want people to do it that way. They really wanted you to use buttons, or arrow keys. But, you know, on 3DS, certainly you could use a circle pad and the face buttons. I think that would work really well. I'm pretty sure the game is still coming to Vita. I think that'll be fine. It'll probably let you use either the D-pad or the joysticks. But it's really fun. I mean, it's very hard. And it's not really a roguelike, but it's set up in a similar structure where you're not really expected to make progress that you can keep. So you start the game and you kind of blast through it and you get as far as you can and then you die and then it starts over. And that's okay because it's an action game. It's not an RPG. It's not about trying to build up your character a whole lot or anything like that. But you will find items every time you go through. And some of them are, they're not really Zelda-like items. A lot of them are stat boosts. some of them are special attacks or like little familiars that'll, like a little bird or something like that, that'll kind of circle around you and help you out a little bit. But, you know, most of them make a minor difference, but they stack up and you can get more and more. And sometimes it helps. But the cool thing about it, and the reason that, you know, even though it is hard and you die a lot and you always restart with basically nothing, I found it very easy to just, as soon as I died, I just wanted to play again. And that's partly because the game is pretty fast paced and it's familiar in some ways, you know, especially for a Nintendo fan. And also because I felt like every time I played, I always saw something new. I'd always see a new enemy or a new element of the levels, and especially a new power up. There's so many different kinds of power ups. You'll only get probably 5 or 6 in any given playthrough, but you always see something different, and they don't really tell you what things do most of the time. And so a lot of times you find something, and the only way to learn how to use it is just to experiment. And the whole game, it always feels like you're experimenting, and you know, you don't know if you're going to do well or not. So it's interesting. It's fun. You know, I don't have a problem with the themes. Certainly some people do, and I would say those people should not buy it. But I think it's very unfortunate that Nintendo would keep this off the store. Anyway, another game I played on the Vita actually was Dragon Fantasy Book 2. And I might have talked about Book 1 a while back. It's kind of this kind of clunky mixture of like the original Dragon Quest and the original Final Fantasy. So it's very old school. And because of that, it's not that great. It has kind of a charming style to it, but and some of the writing is pretty funny. But Book 1 is just so clunky. It's old-fashioned to a fault. And because of that, it's kind of hard to play nowadays. It just feels so antiquated and it's very slow and stodgy. Book 2 is, I actually first played this at PAX East this year and I was very interested because it looks like Chrono Trigger. If you just see a screenshot or even if you see someone playing it, like I did at the demo at PAX East, it looks like Chrono Trigger. I was like, holy crap. I'd never even heard of Book 1 at that point. So, and at the time they told me they were trying to get these games onto, 3DS and Wii U. I don't know what the status is on that, but, Sony worked with them and got them out on PS3 and Vita first. And, you know, again, I wouldn't necessarily recommend Book 1 very much. Book 2 is a huge improvement in a lot of ways. And it is, you know, it makes the leap from 8-bit style to 16-bit style. And this is an area where a lot of indie RPGs have not really gotten to yet. A lot of them still look like 8-bit games. And this one pulls off the Chrono Trigger look very well. The art style is very similar. You know, it doesn't have the, like, Toriyama character designs, but that may be an improvement for some people. You know, Captain Same Face, as I learned about last week.
yeah.
It certainly doesn't. I'll say the other big similarity to Chrono Trigger that is worth mentioning is the way that you encounter enemies, because there's no separate screen. There are no random battles or anything like that. It's more like Earthbound, you know, or Chrono Trigger. So you walk, it's more like Chrono Trigger. You walk around. If you see an enemy and you get close enough to them, you'll start fighting them on the same screen. It's just the menu pulls up and now you're in a battle. And the other cool thing is, if enemies, you know, enemies that kind of march around or they go in a circle or whatever, they kind of roam. And if another enemy from the edge of the screen happens upon your ongoing battle, it will just jump in and join. And so the battle will get a little bit longer at that point. Maybe a different kind of enemy will jump in. And also some of the special attacks have, sort of spatial elements, just like in Chrono Trigger. So some attacks have kind of a blast radius, and if, you know, depending on the way the enemies are positioned, you might catch more than one. Sometimes the attacks go in a line, and so if you choose an enemy that's at the back, maybe you'll go through some of the enemies in front of it on your way there, and so you'll end up hitting more than one. And the healing effects are the same way. So that part is definitely a lot like Chrono Trigger, but it doesn't have the music, it doesn't have the story. The gameplay feels a lot more scattered to me. The story weirdly is very heavily predicated on you having played Book One, and you know, the story in Book One isn't that great in the first place. So I'm not really happy with the fact that they're kind of, it's a direct continuation with the same characters and all that. I think it did bring over my character data from the first game and my levels and everything. So that was kind of cool, but it's like, you know, it is nostalgic in a way. It's interesting. It's a little buggy and has some frame rate problems, which I think is kind of ridiculous for a game like this.
Yeah, really.
The menu designs are not that great. And I had a huge problem with the first game because you can't skip to the bottom of a menu by pushing up at the top of it. So the menus are these long lists and they don't wrap around. And I thought, okay, well, that's probably intentional because they want it to be old fashioned and they want you to get frustrated with it, just like we did back in the 80s.
Well, that's stupid.
That's just dumb, yeah.
This is a 16-bit style RPG, and it still doesn't do that. And some of these menus get really long. And luckily, you can use the touchscreen, actually, on the Vita to kind of scroll through that way, and that's a lot faster. But if you're trying to use the physical controls, it's just very slow-paced to get through some of that stuff. So it's a little irritating. It's not as modern as I would have hoped.
Yeah, the best throwbacks are the ones that can capture the feeling of playing these old games without capturing the inconveniences and the things that we hated.
Exactly.
There were certain things that in those old games that were so bad that it was a huge improvement when they were removed or fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Just because something's old doesn't mean it actually works or is good.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you hit an enemy and you kill it, does the next person who wants to attack it just not do anything, or no, at least move on to the next enemy?
Yeah, that's my favorite.
They will auto choose. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Phew.
I was hoping they would just pass or just defend. That's what I prefer. But
it's not that bad. But yeah, it's an interesting game. I would hope that, you know, since it appears there will be at least a few months before they bring it out on Nintendo platforms, I would hope that they get a chance to tighten it up a little bit and fix some of these things. And I'll say they've already patched it once. I don't know what it did, but they are actively working on it. And in the first game, they actually patched it more than a month after the game came out. On Vita, and like rebalance some things and change some of the stats to make the battles a little less annoying. So I think their head's in the right space. You know, it's a very small team and they may just have limited resources to work on this stuff. But, you know, I think they're interested in making the games good. So, you know, I think it's interesting and has a lot of potential. It's worth keeping an eye on for sure. And then my last game I'll be really quick about, just because I want to throw it to John, but this recommendation is actually for John, for a game called Super House of Dead Ninjas, which is a Steam game.
Which is amazing.
You can get it for like $5 probably. It's actually an Adult Swim game that started out as a Flash game, I think, and then they added the Super, and they added a lot of content to it, and they made it a game you can actually buy and play as much as you want. And that's the one that's on Steam. It is basically like a modern Ninja Gaiden. It's very fast paced. It's very, very difficult, but it's so satisfying and it's really fun. And it has tons of bonus weapons and special powers and like stat boosts that you get that are basically unlocked by just, doing achievements. So as you play the game, you know, some of them are just, you play the game a certain number of times, or you survive for a certain amount of time, or you killed a certain number of enemies total over every time you've ever played. And some of them are like, you killed 3 enemies at once, or, you know, you did something really, really fast, or you died a certain number of times in less than a minute. You know, so I mean, they're just all kind of random things, but every time you do one of those, it'll unlock a weapon that will change the way you play through the game the next time you do it. And the game, any given playthrough of the game is less than 5 minutes long. It's really, really fast paced and it's really crazy difficult. But over time, as you play it more and more, you will get farther. You will see new things and you'll get better at it. So I've actually been playing it with the keyboard, which sucks, but it's still so much fun that I kept wanting to play it, even though I was getting like cramps and is really not a very good way to play the game. So I'm excited to get an Xbox controller or something and plug it into my Surface Pro and play the game that way, because that's clearly the preferred method. But I think, John, I think you would like it, and I think a lot of people would like it.
So how is the game actually set up? I mean, is it some sort of endless runner kind of thing? You just try to get as far as you can, or what?
It's kind of something like that, yeah. Like, you start at the top of this tower, and it's interesting in that you start at the top of the tower, and you're actually working your way down. And so there's a Zelda-style down thrust that's a very, very important part of the game, because you spend a lot of the game jumping from one level down to the next one down, because that is sort of the direction that you're always moving. And you know, there's lots of spikes and things to fall on top of that'll kill you, so you have to be careful anytime you do that. There's also a timer that's constantly ticking down. It starts at 30 seconds, but as you play more, it'll get longer. And if you don't find one of the clock items before that thing counts to zero, this big phantom thing will come out and chase you and kill you pretty quickly. So that encourages you to always keep moving forward very, very fast, because you're always trying to get to the next clock. to reset that timer. So it's obscenely fast and very frantic and like very bloody, but in a ridiculous 8-bit kind of a way.
Yeah.
But it's great. The music is good. I really like everything about it. Yeah. So it's super House of Dead Ninjas, and I think it's at the most $8 on Steam, and
on
a sale you can get it for a lot less than that. But it's very, very easy to recommend.
Cool.
That's all I got.
Sweet. So I'm gonna toss it over to John then.
All right, man. Well, finally happened. I finally got my Wii U.
Woo-hoo! We're finally not talking about Ninja Gaiden.
Yeah, finally.
Nice.
I could spare a couple.
No,
more
you
words.
Can't.
All right. Okay.
I think you can get Ninja Gaiden on Wii U.
Oh, God.
Because I love paying for games over and over again on different systems.
Yes, you
and
do.
It's exactly the same.
What's your point?
I love it. Anyways, yeah, so I got it got in the mail last Friday. Ordered it from Newegg, finally arrived. So Friday was mainly, I pick it up Friday night. That was mostly spent just kind of like unwrapping everything and kind of setting everything up and that whole kind of just checking everything out, making sure everything works and all that kind of stuff, right? So I really didn't really get into gaming very much until Saturday, and that was mainly spent playing Super Mario Brothers, new Super Mario Brothers U. So what I actually, the games that I actually have, I have new Super Mario Brothers U. I got Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate, and I immediately, you get the download card for Wind Waker, so I downloaded Wind Waker. I also got Earthbound. So I haven't touched Wind Waker or Earthbound. They're just, I'll get to them at some other point. Really what I wanted to play right out of the gate was New Super Mario Brothers. I've played with Monster Hunter a little bit. I just kind of, that was sort of some setup too. I got the online stuff set up, and I got the transfer app. I got that, installed that, made sure that all works. That all works fine. So I'm kind of like, at some point, I'm just kind of sit down and tackle that. That's kind of like a project, but I want to get, Mario out of the way first. So it was interesting setting it up because, I the way I have my PS3 and my 360 set up is, I have a PC monitor that I use as an HDMI output. And then I run RCA cables to my older, I have some older audio equipment. I have a receiver and stuff that I just use RCA output for. And I've used that in the past for Wii, and I've used that still to this day for my 360 and my PS3. So I set up my Wii U, and I go into the TV setup area, which is where they also have the audio stuff. And I quickly realize that there's no separate way to configure your audio output. I thought, well, that's kind of weird. You must be able to do this. And I figured out after a while that after doing some searching online and just kind of playing around to figure it out, I realized that the way that it was set up was that if you used HDMI for video, you were forced to use HDMI for audio as well. So I was pretty much shit out of luck. There was no way. I either had to use Component, and of course, with Component, my PC monitor only does Component up to 1080i, not 1080p.
Yeah.
So I was pretty much kind of screwed. I really didn't know what I was going to do.
Yeah, I'm not even sure that Component supports 1080p on any display.
Yeah, it does. It does.
Okay. Well, HDMI would look much better anyway, though.
Exactly, right? So I was like, I was thinking, what am I going to do? Am I going to have to, because you can get an adapter. One of the guys on Twitter that linked me an adapter on Amazon that you can get, but it's like $45. And what it does is it extracts the HDMI audio stream so you can output it to RCA cables, right? I mean, it's a one-off thing. It's just a goofy thing that I don't even need, right? I would buy it. I'd be spending almost $50 for this one purpose, when it should be something that's in there. So I'm like, I was just like, all right, I'm going to hold off on that. I don't know. Maybe Nintendo will patch it. I have no idea. But for the moment, maybe I'll just play games on the gamepad. I don't know. Or do something. I really didn't know what I was going to do. So Sunday night, I was quite perturbed. I went to bed an angry man. All right. They say you shouldn't go to bed angry, but I did. I was angry at Nintendo. So on Monday, I wake up and I go to work. And at work, on Twitter, I start seeing like Nintendo Wii U firmware has been released. And I'm like, that's kind of weird. So I come home and apply it, and of course it takes like 2 hours to apply.
It's so slow.
It took forever to apply that firmware.
That was PS3 level firmware installed.
Yeah.
Because when it's done and then it starts over again, you're like, oh, now I need to do more.
Yeah, it just took forever to install.
Fuck
I
you,
mean,
progress bar.
Yeah, like it takes you forever to download it. Then you have to install it. I don't know. So it took a long time. And so lo and behold, I just, you know, I was like doing some other stuff and I come back and it's finished. So I go into the audio setup and hot damn, they actually fixed it. So pretty much I complained about it and I was like, you know, this is garbage. One day, literally the next day, unbeknownst to anybody, I mean, I don't think anybody had any clue that that firmware was coming out.
No. They just dropped it on.
Well, it's not really the fall update that they've promised with the speed increases, is it?
No,
it's more
not.
Of an interim update, it seems like.
I don't know, isn't it, though? Because it has kind of sped up some things.
Well, it's possible that they've done some things to improve things, and they're just still working on it. But it wasn't the big one they've been touting for, like, half a year at this point.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we would have gotten a press release going, we've done it! We've solved it!
Well, you would have gotten a YouTube video with a side-by-side comparison, probably.
I did get an email from Nintendo, though, telling me I was going to need to re-agree to the terms of service.
I got that, too, and I no longer own a Wii U. So I thought that was like a real kick in the shin from Nintendo.
Well, they didn't know.
Yeah, that's terrible.
But it was like, oh, this is new. Mm-hmm. I've not seen this before.
Yeah, it's like, geez, I wish I had time and energy to actually go through the privacy policies to see. That's the whole thing, right? That by the time you get that email, they've already replaced the policy, so you can't go back and compare it, you know?
Right. But, oh yeah, it's gone.
Yeah, it's like, make sure you accept this new one, but yeah, this is, you have no idea really what's changed.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not, they're all pretty much the same, as long as, oh, and by the way, we're taking pictures of you at every second.
Yeah, well, this was probably the one where they removed your right to take class action lawsuits. Because, you know, that comes out after a while with every one of these companies after they get sued a couple times. And they're like,
yeah,
we're going to write into this privacy policy that you just can't.
You must agree to arbitration.
Exactly. You must agree to arbitration.
It's like, by the way, the gamepad actually has wheels. We hide them. At night, it wakes up and takes pictures of you while you sleep.
Yep.
uploads them to Miiverse.
But don't worry about it. Just click accept.
That's right. You can't. Actually, if we get pictures of you, you can't see that part of Miiverse if you don't. You can.
So, yeah. So, amazingly enough, hey, it was an incredibly wild timing. I had a problem one day, and the next day, I just didn't have that problem anymore.
Maybe they heard you, John. Maybe they heard you with their amended privacy policy, let them listen to you talk.
That seems like a really specific thing that probably affects a very small number of users, but they've actually done a really good job of fixing things like that. Like, there was a screen size, like a what was it, where you could kind of set the margins and change the, you know, sort of where you get those frames on the corners of the screen and you can sort of change where they are. And that's really important for a lot of people's HDTVs because people, you know, they have different margins on that stuff. And the original system on launch day did not have very many options on that. And it was really crappy. And I had on my Wii, or like you could change it in the eShop and the Miiverse, but not on the home screen. It was really weird.
Yeah, it was something dumb like that. Yeah, it was awful.
It was really crazy. And it took a few months, but they did eventually fix that. And it was like, wow, that's a huge improvement. I don't have to deal with any of that stuff anymore. And the Miiverse, we don't talk about it very much, but they have made incredible improvements to the Miiverse.
Oh, yeah, week after week.
Almost like every couple of weeks, they add some kind of new feature that's really, really nice, you know, and that just like changing the number of friends you can have and changing the kinds of stuff you can put in the posts. And I think now you can post to your feed without actually having it associated with a specific game. And then they added the thing where you can share photos online, and they added the thing where you can check Miiverse from a web browser now, and all this stuff. And it's just constant. And if you don't actually go to the Miiverse, you wouldn't even know about it because they don't make a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they're just sort of content to let Miiverse sort of grow organically. I think they want it to be integrated into the games more than it to be its own thing. I think they just want you to say, well, I'm, you know, I go here through the game, I'm playing, and that's how I interface with the Miiverse. I mean, Wonderful 101 basically badgers you to post things to the Miiverse constantly.
Yeah, well, so does New Super Mario Brothers. Yeah,
oh, Mario's it's kind of irritating about it too. Actually,
yeah, it's a little bit irritating, but you know what? I kind of like it because what I like, I mean, I like Miiverse overall. Actually, I like Miiverse a lot more than I thought I would. Because when I first heard about it, I thought, well, why don't they just have it so you can post to Twitter? And, you know, I think that's probably what a lot of people think. But what I like about it, and this kind of struck me when I first started to interact with it, I was like, what's cool about it is the fact that everybody on there is only on there because they really, really like Nintendo. So that increases the fact that people – that you're going to get a positive response. You don't get –
Oh, yeah.
You
know, John has six yes right now.
Yeah. That's, I'm a yeah machine. I know. But that's but that's the thing, right? Like you're pretty much – I mean it's such a targeted
audience.
Every post
John put on to Guillaume is yes plus.
it's such a targeted audience that it's just kind of – it makes – you know, kind of sharing things that you do in those games a lot more enjoyable. And also what I like is, you know, it's kind of seeing like, you know, the little kind of like, you know, heads on the map in Mario Brothers where you can see people's comments as they play through the game. So it's kind of a cool thing that I wouldn't even have thought of. You know, if you would have told it to me, I would have said, whatever, that's just another goofy Nintendo idea. You know, they just like to do weird stuff like that, but it's actually really cool because you can kind of experience the thoughts of people playing through the game as they played through it. You know,
it's breadcrumbs.
Yeah, it's incredibly cool, and you know, very rarely is anything ever spoiled for you. You know, you can clearly mark spoilers and stuff like that. So it's just kind of cool, like when you play through an area that's really, really hard and you're like, man, that was a pain in the ass. And then you look at somebody's comment and they're like, yep, this level's a complete pain in the ass. So, yeah, so I think that's really, really cool.
I mean, one thing for me that Mermiverse really did well is in Scribblenauts, which you think, well, why? Well, because it's a game where you get to create stuff. So, like, I created a Kirby. It walks around. It gets bigger and smaller. It's, you know, it looks like Kirby. And, you know, I just posted to Miiverse with just the words Kirby, well, how he says it, Kirby. And, like, I got responses from people who don't follow me, who I'm not friends with. They just, you know, they just happened across it popping up on that screen, on that home screen. And they're like, oh, that looks neat.
Or they went to the Scribblenauts community and it was just in the feed there.
Yeah, they just saw it. And, like real conversations with people, like, going like, hey, try putting this over there and see if you can make it look a little bit more... Get the face a little bit better. Or like people posting the things they created. Like somebody created a Bowser, even though Bowser's already in the dumb thing, and created like a bigger one. And I'm like, ah! And it was just like their responses. It fostered real conversation. People who were playing this game, as opposed to me just throwing something out into the Twitter stream and hoping somebody is watching their feed and playing that game and has the ability to take screenshots.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the last videos that Ryan Davis did with Giant Bomb was a quick look of Game & Wario. And the vast majority of that video, of that quick look, is them on the game where you – it's kind of like a game of telephone or something where you – they have like a theme and people draw things on Miiverse. And I think you just kind of pick your favorite or something like that, or you try to guess what it is. And he was absolutely giddy about this. He thought it was the greatest thing because he loved, you know, seeing also the, I think you could actually suggest your own topics, and they were very kind of, maybe not, so kosher with copyright law and stuff like that, you know? So maybe people were like, draw Eminem, you know, and then people would draw Eminem, and some of the drawings are so bad, but some of them are really, really surprisingly good. And he just seemed incredibly fascinated by it. I was shocked at how long they spent on that thing. And of course, the best part of that is you don't really need Game & Wario to enjoy that. You can actually just go to the Miiverse community for that part of Game & Wario, and you can sort of enjoy all that stuff without buying anything.
The appeal of that is that you're effectively playing with everyone playing that game at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Even though you're not.
It's a very cool use of internet, especially coming from Nintendo.
Yeah, it's extremely clever. It taps into that whole concept of playing through these games as a shared experience rather than just you kind of playing it by yourself, experiencing it by yourself, and then maybe talking to people about it after the fact.
Like doing this.
Yes.
So if you don't have a weekly 2-hour long podcast, there you go. Miiverse.
Yeah, so I win both ways, really.
Yeah. John, really?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. Victory's tough to come by lately, James. You know what I mean?
So, John, how's Mario?
Mario's fun. I mean, I won't really go too much into it just because everybody kind of knows what the deal is, but yeah, I mean, I just have to say that the HD, I mean, graphics really do make things a lot better just because
it's a little surprising, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it just makes it makes what they can do, the kind of stuff they can pull off stuff on a much larger scale. The worlds look really nice and, you know, vibrant. So I'm really enjoying that one. One more thing just to wrap up here, I also got a Pro Controller, and I'm not too impressed with it. It's good, but not great. I mean, I know I've heard a lot of high praise about the Pro Controller. But for me, my problem with it is the fact that the face buttons are like too far down and to the left.
Yeah.
So
they're kind of weird.
Yeah. The problem that I kept running into was I was using Y and B for New Super Mario Brothers. And what was always happening was I wound up mashing all four buttons at one time. And so I started using X and A, which it feels right, but it just seems really weird. So I just feel like the placement of the face buttons is really strange.
But at least that's a solution. I mean, at least you can do that.
Yeah. At least for that game.
Yeah.
I do like the image of John pressing all four buttons and going, why are my thumbs so big?
Well, that's the thing. It'll completely screw you because it'll make you, you know, when you're like in the middle of something, your guy will do a twist or something and you'll just die. You'll fall to your death.
Oh, it's so good. All right. So I'm going to wrap up new business with Guillaume.
Yeah, I was planning this week on telling you guys that I, you know, like, oh, I cleaned up my backlog. I finished like all the coins in New Luigi. I finished Wonderful 101. I finished Shin Megami Tensei 4, but really I only finished Shin Megami Tensei 4 about 5 minutes before we started recording this podcast. I majorly underestimated the amount of time that was left to play through an RPG.
I'm always impressed at your commitment to actually finishing these games, because it always seems like you go through a trough where I would have just quit.
Yeah, I did quit on Persona 3, but that was just like I couldn't see an end in sight. This had kind of an end in sight. But anyway... no, but it was not going anywhere. The story was not engaging, and there was no... variation in the gameplay. Whereas here, I don't know, like, I guess I should have been more informed when I went into it. The thing is, okay, I've explained the last time I talked about the game, this doing side quests is really, really needlessly convoluted. Like, after you receive a quest, like, you can go to a bar, a hunter's bar, or you can talk to demons who will give you quests, or you can talk to random people in towns, and they give you quests. And once they give you a quest, you have to select it to make it your current quest. And you cannot have two quests going on at the same time. And moving through the main game, like the main quests, also count as these quests.
So, wait, the side quests and the regular quests are effectively bundled together?
You can only have one of those going on at a time.
Oh.
If you are trying to move through the game... to get further ahead in the story, you have to quit out of whatever side quest you're doing. When you're doing a side quest, you're putting your main quest on hold.
That's the anti-Xenoblade.
It's the stupidest thing I've ever seen.
Oh my god.
And as I explained last time, when you're in a side quest, you might reach a point where it says, like, you can't really go there without quitting out of the quest you're in now. So you're like, oh, okay, well, I am just not going to go there. I'm going to look around, I'm going to finish this quest, and then I'm going to go to this place that's not letting me go. And then, like, you'll give up eventually, and what you needed for that quest that you just quit out of was behind the part that was locked off. You know? So that happened to me. It's extremely unpleasant, and that's why I didn't do many side quests while I was playing the game. And, you know, like, there's very little direction when you get a side quest. Like, it doesn't even tell you who gave it to you. You have a list, and you only have the titles and a vague description. But, you know, they're vague to a fault. And it's just, you know, like, it will tell you, oh, you know, you gotta go south of, you know, Shibuya, north of Shibuya. And it's like, well, there's like four or five different parts to Shibuya. So which one are you talking about? Or are you telling me I should exit into the world map and go north of Shibuya? Like, it's always a pain in the ass to try to figure out what the actual thing that they're asking you to do is. And, so yeah, and the quests can be, you know, like the people that you need to talk to finish a quest will not exist on the world map unless you are inside that quest.
Mm.
So, you know, like if my quest is to go talk to this dude, this dude doesn't exist unless I'm doing the quest. So there's no way that I can, you know, like take a note and think like, hey, this guy is weird and I probably will need to talk to him later about something and I should take note of that and where he is. No, like that would be too simple.
And at this point, you're at the end of the game. So, I mean, you're familiar with lots of areas and lots of characters from before that. So it'd be nice if they could, you know, reference you back to someone you've maybe talked to before and say, oh, yeah, I know where that guy is.
Well, yeah, but no, like all that you see is like on the periphery of many areas. There are these small rooms and you just like there's nothing there. And you enter them, it says there's no one here. And that means that there's going to be something at some point.
I love
but...
the literalistness of that. Yeah, there's no one here. Nope, nobody's here.
So yeah, I didn't bother with the side quest. And then I really wanted, you know, there are several different endings to this game. So I wanted to get the correct one the first time around. And that turned out to be a huge mistake. Because I think that the game would have been over much quicker if I had gone like one side or the other. But I took the middle neutral path, the best path in the game, as I explained. And that makes it so that you have to go back and do all those fucking side quests.
Nice! Oh, you got trolled by the game!
And like, I just, I want to make this as painless as possible. I had on my lap, my laptop, and I had two tabs for two different FAQs, and I had one tab open for Google Maps to have some sort of view of Tokyo, because navigating...
Guillaume's having to learn to navigate Tokyo!
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And, you know, like, it would be nice if the game, like, the world map in the game was easy to navigate, but it's not. Your view is very zoomed in. If you want to see where a street leads, you have to go down it. And then you see, oh, okay, this was a dead end after all. Or, like, this is not the way, and then you go back. And, you know, like, there are times when there's no route on the world map. You have to go through a town and then exit somewhere else. Like, it's a huge pain in the ass. So navigating is not fun, and during that whole time, yes, the enemies are visible on the world map, but they're almost impossible to avoid. When they see you, they rush you, whether they're level 99 or level 1. So when you're a super badass towards the end of the game, and you're getting rushed by these enemies all the time that don't give you any any experience points, it's just, like, seriously, give me a break, game. So I was just like ranting on Twitter and what the hell? Like, I don't want to play this anymore. I'm going to give up. I'm giving up. And then I posted on Twitter and then I was like, no, I got to finish this.
You're not just a quitter. You're a quitter.
Yeah. I'm through with quitting.
So I picked the game back up and I unlocked something that I hope, like, this is not a spoiler. I wish someone had told me this was in there, but there's a way that you can gain a flying ability so you can fly over the world map. And I got that very late in the game. I don't know how early it is possible to get it, but I wish I had gotten it as early as possible, because when you're flying, you don't get attacked. It's just, it makes so many things so much easier.
That sounds huge. That sounds like a game-changing
Yeah, item. But you have to find like the three parts of this deity. Like, it's been, you have to put it back together, and you know the three parts are probably in three different corners of Tokyo. So it's kind of a pain in the ass to get. But anyway, so that made a huge difference. And then, you know, it took me maybe one evening to finish all the side quests. And then once I was back in the dungeons, actually, like once I was back doing, basically you have to do the ending sequence for the lawful path and then the ending sequence for the chaos path. You know, you have to do them both because you're neutral. And so, once I was in the dungeons, then I had a functional map that told me where I had been and where I should go. And everything was so much more straightforward, and I was fighting enemies at my level, and it was so much more a pleasant experience. And I'm actually glad that I finished the game. Like, I'm actually glad that I kept playing. But that was a rough patch, and if there's one, if there's one piece of advice that I want to give listeners is, if you play through this game, pick, you know, like the lawful or the chaos path. Don't try to get the best thing in the first, like, just YouTube it. It's not worth it.
I enjoy the image of Guillaume playing cartographer of Tokyo streets while he's trying to get through Shin Megami Tensei.
That is what you need to do. Like, it's no fucking joke. There's no, there are these warp points in the game where you can warp from one district to the next, and it's just a list. You know, like Shibuya, Shinjuku, and anything. Like, I'm not a game designer, but I would have put a map of Tokyo there. And, like, I would have made lit up, you know, little dots on the map to where these warp points led. You know, it's not that complicated.
But everybody knows where Shibuya is, so it's fine.
I know it's in Japan.
Yeah.
What international audience?
So, Guillaume, you've made it quite clear that I do not ever want to play Shin Megami Tensei 4. But I'm curious. I mean, you obviously spent so much time with the game. You just finished it, so it's really, really fresh on your mind. But do you feel happy about it? I mean, do you feel like you really like this game after all the abuse that you took from it?
The abuse was for a couple of hours, and then it got better. Like, it did get better. I enjoyed it more towards the end, and I had a good time. And I had a good time before that. So, yeah, like, my opinion drastically changed in three different parts of the game. Early on, and then in that stupid part, and then at the end. So it's really weird. If I had had to review this game, my score would have depended entirely on where I stopped playing. but yeah, I'm glad I played it. I'm glad I played a Shin Megami Tensei game. I'm just, you know, glad I tried something different. I play a lot of platformers. They're kind of my comfort food gaming. And, you know, if I had played another Dragon Quest game, I would have felt more like I had wasted my time. I'm just glad that I've discovered something new. But I'm at the same time, I'm not eager to go back ever again to the mainline Shin Megami Tensei series.
Yeah, but I mean,
one was enough.
Yeah, that's the thing. At least you can say you've played the series, and you can kind of talk about it in an informed manner now.
Why would we do that? If you don't do that on this show.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's no prereq for this show, but...
But yeah, I'm just glad that I played one of these games. Like, it's a curiosity. Just like, what's the big deal? Well, now I know what the big deal is.
That's fair enough. I think it's sometimes it's important to try to play games just to sort of see what they're like.
Yeah.
I mean, it's how you both grow your interests and grow as an informed person on the industry.
Yeah, and it just it does a lot of things correctly. There's just a few places where it's strangely user unfriendly and really archaic, and I don't understand. Like, I would have thought that every Atlas team knew what they were doing.
Oh no!
But not at the same level. No,
that's definitively not a true statement.
Apparently, they don't talk to each other. They don't have the same priorities.
I would say the more accurate statement is, most of the Atlas teams have some concept of what they are doing. And that's the highest praise I'll give that company.
I just wish that one of the dudes from Etrian Odyssey, the Etrian Odyssey team, or the Persona team, had kind of a Miyamoto-like influence over the rest of Atlas to tell them, no, cut that shit out.
The Persona team is probably the Shin Megami Tensei team, isn't it?
No, it's not.
Really?
It's not.
It's
no,
a different
team. But I mean, keep in mind that that's what Atlas fans like. They like that bullshit. To them, it's part and parcel with what they want.
Yeah, and when you say they, you mean you.
Japan. I didn't say me. I'm not a big fan of Strange Journey. Thank you.
Okay. But you are a huge Atlas fan.
Some of their licenses, yeah. But I mean, I would say definitively, there's not a team in Atlas I go, this is a sterling group. There's always like, yeah, this is a motley crew right here. What are you guys doing?
You take the good with the bad.
Yeah, you pretty much do. And for reference, Shinjuku is north of Shibuya, which is then north of Meguro, which is on the Tokyo Bay.
Ooh.
So I do actually know where it is. Boom! All right, and with that geography knowledge
inside Shibuya
bomb,
with James Jones.
We're going to you go inside. we're gonna go ahead and wrap up new business. Yo. Stay tuned. We'll be back with some listener mail.
It's the podcast, people.
You keep right on hosting there, James.
You host your little heart out, James.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have impressions of Super Mario 3D World by Aaron Kaluska. Aaron wasn't overly impressed by the newest Mario game in E3, but he had another crack at it recently and just may have changed his tune. Check out what he has to say about the new levels he played, as well as the multiplayer, and what he doesn't like about it. Hint, it has to do with the cat suit.
Okay, we also have an interview about the eShop with Dan Adelman and Damon Baker from Nintendo, and that interview is by Curtis Bonds. Kurt Dog recently sat down with Dan and Damon at the Nintendo eShop operation to discuss all sorts of things about what makes the eShop tick. How do they feel about third-party publishers on Wii U? What games would they like to see on the eShop? Curtis gets the answers. And we're also going to have a blog. It's not up yet, but it will be by the time you hear this, a blog by me. First time I've written for the site in quite a while, since E3 probably. And I wrote a pretty long, exhaustive blog, sort of editorial piece about why Shadow of the Eternals did not work out on Kickstarter and Mighty No. 9 did. And sort of comparing the differences between how those two Kickstarters were set up and how they were run. So I hope you'll find that interesting as well.
All right, and we also have a blog from Neil Ronahan, why the Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze delay isn't that bad. Crying in your Cheerios about DK Tropical Freeze being delayed in 2014.
I'm not crying. No.
Neil says, and I quote verbatim, there, little one. Rest your weary head on my shoulder, and let me tell you why everything's going to be okay.
I'm not drunk enough for this.
He then gives you a cup of cocoa and tucks you into bed.
Aww.
It's Neil. Thank you, Daddy. He cares. Neil cares.
And finally, we have a review of Scribblenauts Unmasked, a DC Comics adventure by Neil Ronahan. The review is by Neil, not the DC not Comic Adventure, unfortunately.
He's actually within the comics.
They would be way better than the average DC comic.
Scribblenauts, starring Neil. Awesome.
He is a comic adventure unto himself.
Neil's always been a fan of the Scribblenauts games, but could be better than Scribblenauts mixed with awesome DC characters. According to Neil, actually quite a lot, and we aren't even talking about Christian Bale's voice in the Dark Knight movies.
All
swear to me!
All this well and done. Way less than that voice on NintendoWorldReport.com. So we're back, and before we get to listener mail, I guess Johnny, would you like to tell us a little bit about your experience of the last few weeks?
Oh, man. Okay, I'll try to make it fairly brief. But I got a lot of questions, and I think it's a pretty dramatic story. So I thought it might be worth putting on the show, just because nothing like this has ever happened to me before, and hopefully will never happen to a lot of people, to anyone else listening. But I wanted to explain my absence a little bit, especially since I was actually on 350, so
it was really weird.
Yeah, by the time my life had completely fallen apart, you know, the podcast was going out and everything sounded totally fine when I was on there, except for the part in the middle where everyone was talking about how sorry they were for me. So
it was actually the night we recorded, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That was the weird thing, because I remember just before we signed off. This
yeah, you're
was
like,
after,
it's raining, really, it's lot,
yeah.
lot of rain.
And you're like, you know, it's weird. There's like this flash flood warning for my area, but I don't know what that's about. It was so bizarre.
Yeah,
it
I was getting like text messages on my phone from like the local, you know, emergency service or whatever saying, hey, there's a flash flood warning. And to me, that just means don't go anywhere. You know, don't
right.
drive, just sit tight. And, you know, I live in Colorado in like high altitude desert country. It's about mm-hmm. the last place you would ever think you might get flooded. And I don't even live near a creek or a river or anything. It's just yeah. the way the land lays, a bunch of water from uphill just kind of funneled right into my apartment complex and filled up the parking lot and the area right around my apartment. And there wasn't good drainage. So it just collected there until it was really, really deep.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it happened, I guess. But anyway, I mean, yes, it happened on the night of us recording our parts of episode 350. I was going to be 2 days later. I was going to record with Evan and Greg, and I was really excited to do that. And, you know, I went to bed, you know, I had, I'd actually, normally I upload my podcast audio the night that we do it, but that night I had just forgotten, we went late, I'd had a couple of beers, wasn't really all that concerned about it. And so anyway, I go
Fate
to bed,
conspires.
I go to bed normally. I was actually just really happy with how the show had gone. And I was really looking forward to doing the other part of it and had had a really good night. I went to bed. It was raining really hard, but it had been, at that point, it had been raining for like 3 days straight, which is really unusual. Very, very strange, but you know, it's just rain, right? So anyway, I go to bed and I wake up. And it's about 2:30 in the morning. And I wake up, and I'm not really sure why, because I wasn't having a bad dream or anything like that. I just woke up, and I wasn't sure why at first. And I stepped out of bed and stepped into a foot of water. And I was like,
wow.
Oh, shit.
How long did it take you to think, all right, this is real, I'm not dreaming right now?
It was immediate. I mean, that's the thing about water. Like,
oh, yeah, it just wakes you up. You're
yeah,
just like, whoa,
I mean, that's
yeah.
why people like splash water on people to, you know.
Yeah, you're just like, oh.
Yeah, that must have been so surreal.
Oh, my God.
Like, is this actually happening? What the hell is going on?
I was
because
I'd imagine
in,
it was dark.
In shock
was...
or panic mode right away, you know.
Because I'd imagine it was dark, too,
yeah,
right?
Well, of course, it was dark. I mean, my electricity was actually still on. So I look over.
That's
my,
probably a little frightening.
My desktop, yeah. My tower-style desktop computer, which is, you know, at the bottom of my computer desk where I had just recorded RFN a few hours earlier, is, like, glowing underwater.
Oh,
Jesus.
I was like, oh, shit. So I reached over and turned off the power strip because I was like, that ain't good, you know. And but I found, no. I actually reached underwater and found the power strip and turned off the switch to it. And then I reached down there and the microphone was still down there. And so I grabbed it and pulled it up from underwater. The microphone that I have a Zoom microphone that records audio directly to SD card. So it's a microphone/recorder. And that's where my podcast audio, and it was literally one of the very first things I thought was, oh my God, I have to get that audio because we had recorded about like, over 2 hours
oh, yeah.
of huh? just those segments, just the beginning and the end segments. And it was really good stuff, and it was a special episode. And I'm like, no fucking way am I leaving this here in the apartment to be lost forever. And then I look around, and I'm like, okay. I mean, I wasn't wearing any clothes. So I'm like grabbing. I put on a swimsuit and a T-shirt. I didn't have any shoes. I reach over. My phone is underwater because I had set it on the floor. With it plugged into the wall. And so I reach down, I find the cord from the wall, and I follow it down to the end where my phone is, and I pick it up and I pull the plug out, and the phone lights up. So it's still working, you know. So, you know, props to Apple for making a phone that's fairly watertight. So I pull that up, and I'm like, well, I'm going to need this because I need to let people know what's happening here, and I might need to call for help, you know. And about that time, I heard the knocking on the window. And I think in retrospect, that's probably what woke me up in the first place. It turned out that my neighbors were going around trying to knock on everybody on the bottom floor because my apartment was like halfway underground. It was a garden level apartment. And that's a big part of why this happened. And everything was on the same floor. So every room in my apartment flooded at the same time. And I never heard it because flooding is really, really quiet. I mean,
it's probably progressive.
Right, and it probably was making some noise from the water, you know, coming through the cracks in the doors or whatever, but you certainly couldn't have heard it over the pounding rain outside my window, which was really loud. So, I mean, it was so loud I was worried about it picking up on the microphone earlier that night. So anyway, I go over and I dump out a laundry basket and I start filling it up with things that I think I'm going to need. So I grab my 3DS and my Vita and my wallet and my passport, or a basket that I think has my passport in it, because I'm like, I don't know if I'm still going to Europe next week, but if I do, I'm going to be glad that I had this. And I grabbed a few clothes and then I went up to the living room, and the living room is like a horror show. I mean, it looks like something out of that movie Twister, except with water instead of wind. It's ridiculous. Like the wood panels from the floor are floating through the water, and I'm like kicking them with my shins as I walk through, and there's like just random shit floating all over the place. It's really a bizarre scene, you know. And these guys have like flashlights and they're banging on my window. And so I go over there and I open the window, and they're like, hey man, you got to get out of here. Grab anything that you can't replace, and you know, let us come in and we'll turn off the power. So they came in, they found the circuit breaker box, not before I had actually tried to reach over and turn off another power strip at my home entertainment center with all my, you know, all my gaming consoles and everything. And as I go over there, my subwoofer to my soundbar is like floating in the water. And as they get close to it, I could feel the tingles in my legs. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to let that one go. I'm going to give up on that.
That one's done.
Yeah. And at that point, the water, I don't think was up to the level of my consoles, but it eventually rose after I left. It rose up higher and ended up completely submerging all of them.
But that's the thing though, that like from the picture you sent me, I mean, that's just to illustrate, that is probably about 3.5 or 4 feet off the ground.
Yeah, it's bad.
It was about 2.5 or 3 feet. Yeah.
It's bad.
Because what I actually did is I wanted to kind of see how high the water was based. And I mean, because it went up pretty much to like the doorknob on a normal door.
Yeah.
That's high. That's like above your waist.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was
scary. And that's the thing. I didn't know how high it was going to get.
Yeah.
You know? So I was like, I got to get out of here. This could get way worse, you know?
Yeah.
And all these decisions were made like very, very quick. So I'm just going on instinct and just, you know, trying to trust my judgment in the moment. And I'm trying to think, you know, and they said, you know, do you have anything in there that you can't replace? I'm like, well, I've already got my passport. I've got a couple, you know, I've got the podcast recorder. I look over there. I've got two frames sitting up against the wall on the floor, which I was going to be, those and all my posters, some of which were also framed, I was going to be putting up within a couple of days. And I just hadn't gotten around to it because I only lived in this apartment for less than a month.
Yeah.
Oh.
I was like 95% moved in, but there were still a few things I hadn't unpacked, I hadn't put up yet, and they were sitting on the floor. And I reach over there, I got my framed PhD diploma, and I got my framed Roger Waters poster that is signed, which was a birthday gift from my friend Taylor. I was like, these two things, I want to get out of here. And both of them more or less survived. The diploma itself is kind of messed up, but I can get a replacement from the university.
Yeah, that's easy.
The rest of the frame, it's a really nice frame. It was a gift from my parents. So it's really, I got that out. And then the Roger Waters poster is like a little bit crinkled at the bottom from the water, just from being kind of damp, but the ink itself is perfectly fine. It looks, all the colors are normal. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be completely savable, and most people won't even know the difference unless they get really close to it. So that was good thinking. That thing's, you know, worth a lot of money and worth a lot to me in meaning as well. So I got that stuff out of there, and then the guys went over to my closet and they found a pair of shoes for me to put on so that I could actually walk outside through the
water. I like that they picked your shoes out though. That's
well,
nice.
I mean, they just grabbed whatever they found. It was actually a pair of dress shoes that I wear to work.
That are at leather. That point, they're just like, take this shit and let's get out of
here.
So,
were those emergency services?
No, those were neighbors.
Oh, wow.
Those were my neighbors, yeah. They also asked, hey, do you have any beer in the fridge? And I was like, yeah, help yourself.
Awesome.
And then I escaped. The front door actually at one point tried to go over there, but there was so much pressure on it, I couldn't open it. Which is a good thing because the water was actually a lot higher outside than it was inside.
Oh, yeah, it would be.
What?
Think about it. The door's still acting like a dam, just not a very good
one.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So water was coming through it, but it was at least slowing it down. And so I escaped my apartment through the living room window, passing out a laundry basket with everything that I would own for the next like 3 days. and wearing a pair of dress shoes and swim trunks. And
that's
outside,
terrible, but it's funny
it was,
at the same time.
It was pretty bad outside too, because even the ground outside was like, you know, 2 or 3 feet deep of water, even out in the parking lot
and
the ground surrounding it. So you couldn't see where you were walking. It was so deep. It was kind of like walking through a creek. And I was really glad I had those shoes, and you know, those guys had thought of that, because there was a section as we were walking up to the clubhouse of the apartment complex where I ended up spending the night, because it was up on high ground and it still had power and showers. But in the walk up to there, which is like maybe 100 yards away, there was one section we walked through where there was actually a current, because the water was coming through there so hard it was actually flowing. And if I hadn't had shoes on, that might have actually pulled me under and like taken me away. Or at the very least, I might have lost control over the basket with all of my belongings, you know. So I was really glad I had shoes on for that part. But yeah, I made it up to the clubhouse. There were a few other people who had been in a similar situation that were kind of gathering up there because the lights were on and it was high up enough that it was dry. And there were showers, so this water was really dirty and muddy and gross. And so I went in they had showers because there's a pool over there. And so I used the showers and washed myself off. And, And, you know, after, you know, things calmed down a little bit eventually once they got everybody out of there. And, you know, I sent a message to my parents and to my girlfriend and said, hey, I'm okay. But, my parents were actually supposed to be coming that Thursday night to stay with me for the weekend, which is why we had recorded the show on a Wednesday. So I sent a message to my parents. I said, hey, my apartment's flooded. I'm out of there. I'm okay. But if you're still coming to Colorado, you better get a hotel in Denver.
Yeah.
And they did at like 3 a.m. And so, it took me a couple days, but I did finally get a ride out of town and got to meet with them, and I spent the weekend with them. And, you know, it was all this mess of like, does my insurance cover this stuff? What is going on with FEMA? Are the roads okay? What can I salvage out of there? In the end, I basically lost all my furniture. I lost virtually all my electronics. I did actually, my TV ended up being only partially damaged, so it's still... some of the ports on it don't work anymore, but some of them do. So I can at least use that for until it craps out. You know, it may not last very long, but at least in the short term it works. And right. Anything that was stored up high. So my, the clothes that were hanging in my closet, I got those out the next day. Most of my books were up high enough on the bookshelf that they were okay, especially the more valuable ones I had stored higher up.
Ironically, your DVD copy of Hard Rain with Christian Slater was safe.
You know what? I should watch that movie again because I bet I would have a very different... I saw that in the theater back in the 90s, but I would have a very different perspective on it now. I think Morgan Freeman is in it too.
Yeah.
Riding on a Ski-Doo, a Sea-Doo. So I lost a lot of stuff, but I also managed to save a lot of stuff. I mean, it was really depressing going back into the apartment after it was drained out because everything is covered. That's where when I took those photos, everything is just covered in mud. It's really gross. The whole place is just a wreck. And it's like, I'm probably not ever going to live here again, you know, and it was just really took me by surprise. But I had help from lots of people. I had a lot of offers for help. I had a lot of sympathy from people and, you know, and some people who'd been through similar things before and really helped me figure out, you know, what to do next, who do I call, what do I save, how do I start moving on with life. And eventually, you know, we found a friend who had an extra bedroom, and that's where I'm sitting right now recording this show. So, you know, I'm getting my feet back underneath me. It's been a tumultuous couple of weeks because not only were my parents in town for that weekend, so you know, at least I had them for support, even though I, you know, the weekend did not turn out the way we'd originally envisioned it. But at least I got to hang out with them and have a little bit of fun with them. But then a few days later, after I went back to work for a couple of days, the next week I went to Europe for a friend's wedding, which I had been, you know, 6 months in the planning. And it's like, I don't know if I should still do this because it seems like a real bad time. But then at the same time, it was like, there's not a whole lot here tying me down. So right. in a sense, I had to borrow a suitcase for my girlfriend, but in a sense, it was relatively easy for me to just pack up and leave for a week. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be really good for me. I mean, it gave me so much distance from this horrible thing that had happened to me, and it helped me kind of fill up my head with all these new memories and new experiences and, you know, different languages and, you know, all these different locations. And so by the time I got back from Europe, it felt like it had happened 100 years ago, even though it only been a week. And that just really helped me deal with it a lot. So, you know, it was kind of a weird situation. It was like, I've already paid for the whole trip and I can't think of a really good reason not to go, even though it seems like a stupid thing to do right after you lose your home. But I did it, you know.
It's one of those things where it's like, well, what's the harm in this point?
You exactly. Know? Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, I'm not getting a refund for that flight, you know.
Right.
Yep. Yeah.
So
just go.
Yeah. So I just went, and it was great. And now I'm back, and I'm back at work, and I moved to this new place, and you know, I'm like slowly replacing things. I just bought a new podcast microphone last night, but you know, it was such a comfort and, you know, you guys can attest, but like one of my top priorities the next day was I have to make sure that we don't lose this podcast because it's the 350th episode and I'm really proud of it and I really care about it. And if I lose my audio, then you guys can't use what you did either.
Nope.
You know, so mm-hmm. It's like, this isn't just about me. This is about all these other three guys and they put a lot of time into it. And, it's, you know, so I was like, I'll be damned if I lose this podcast. And I did, it took a while to figure out how to get the audio off the SD card, but, we did it. And then when I heard that, you know, when I saw that, you know, you guys were still able to record with Evan and Greg and you got the show out, and I got to listen to it on the way to Europe. It was like, oh, it made me feel so good. I was so happy about that.
So what's amusing? I mean, amusing is a tough word here, but I mean, it really is kind of funny. Is that we had all these editors and former editors on the show in place of the segment that Johnny was going to record on Friday, and it just turned into us commiserating lost episodes because we weren't sure if Johnny's audio was going to be there.
That's right. Yeah. At that time, you didn't know if I was going to – I think I finally recovered it that Saturday morning.
So we were all just basically just going like, God, this could be the worst one yet. And well, we're just basically in – have like a pour one out for the lost episodes segment.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like 10 minutes of us just venting about it and we're just like, so if this is the only segment you hear, you're going to hear about other ones that happened just like this.
Yeah, we lost several over the course of the show. In the early days, it was pretty touch and go.
Oh, it was bad. Like, you just sit there and be like, oh, this has gone wrong.
Well, we've come a long way. And this was just a case of like, look, this recorder is fucked, but all that audio was recorded to the SD card that's inside of it. If I pull that out and I get the right cables and adapters and, you know, yada, 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 I should be able to pull these files off. And it took a few attempts. I had some problems along the way, but I finally get that stuff off. When I looked at it and I saw that it was good audio and it actually worked, I probably like screamed for joy. I was so stressed out about losing that because it's like, this is it. Me, you know, and of course my parents, and my girlfriend were like, why are you so, you know, worried about your stupid podcast audio? I'm like, you don't understand. This really means a lot to me. And, you know, if I can get this out, it will be probably the one thing that I care about the most that I was able to save from the flood, you know, because I lost a lot of stuff. I'm like, I'll be damned if I lose this podcast, this stupid water. And
it would have been just too much.
Yeah. It really would have been a big loss because those are moments that we had together that you can't replace, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, we could always record another show that I may or may not be on.
Yeah, there could always be another 350.
But what we did that night,
right,
you can't recreate. And so I was like, this is, you know, it's a big deal. So I was really happy to do it. And I was excited when it really all worked out very magically in the end. And we had a big special episode. And it was probably one of the most meaningful to me, especially after the fact, you know.
It's a really good episode. And there's a real sense of relief to it.
Like, oh, man.
It's so weird. Like, cause ultimately the second segment is basically like, I hope you heard the first segment just constantly over and over again.
Well, we had to be, you know, like to, take into account the eventuality that it would be the only segment. So, like, how do you record something and you're not even sure, like,
if there's anything else around it? You're just like, I don't know.
I mean, connectivity goes through this every week, and I don't know how they do it because it would drive me crazy.
You're just like, I don't know. Maybe there was a great segment before this one.
So that's where we came up with that was my idea for the episode title, Theme from the Bottom.
Yeah.
Because that episode was recovered literally from underwater.
Yes.
And that's the name of a fish song that's about living under the sea and, you know, been looking up at the water above you and the sun above you. So, I thought it was very appropriate. And you know, I give you guys so much credit for not only for, you know, doing all the stuff that you did that weekend and pull that episode together, but, you know, taking care of things the past couple of weeks as I get everything back in order. It's been a big relief to me to see the show continue on.
It was really more just an issue of just going like, all right, so we're going to need to schedule guests. Mm-hmm. We're going to need to do a retroactive segment. It was really – it was almost kind of nice to have to just plan a show. Like, it's just – you know,
it's a normal show.
Yeah, it was like, I'm just doing a show. I'm not – you know, Johnny's okay. He's in Europe right now. He's probably getting hammered on beer out in Bavaria, whatever. Or Munich. Yeah.
But that's, I mean, really though, it was also out of concern though too, just that we didn't want you to have to worry about anything,
right?
You know what I mean? Because you just had enough bullshit thrown on your plate that you had to deal with, so you just, you know, taking stuff off your plate was of paramount importance.
Like, I felt like I needed to tell Johnny that no, we got a retroactive guest, and it was fucking Greg, who literally just materialized out of thin air like 20 minutes before we recorded.
Yeah,
that was
awesome.
It was just like, no, we're good, we got this, we're fine.
It was cool to hear the follow-up to that. And Pandora's Tower is a game that I have on disc. And so when I do replace my Wii U, I'm actually looking forward to going back and playing that. I was hoping to do it, you know, for the show. But
it was it was for us. It was almost like okay, we're good. We don't have to worry about it. You know, we could do the segment. We could focus on the show, and you know, we know Johnny's okay-ish. You know, he's responding to emails, so we know he's physically okay.
Yeah, I was a little shell-shocked, but
but I mean, for us, it was just, you know, do the show, go through, you know, for the fans. I think there was a sense of we just, you know, this is what we do. The show is us, so we have to do it now.
Yeah, there wasn't that much difference. In my case.
Well, I mean, there was obviously a difference in that Johnny wasn't here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Although it's remarkable just how not indispensable he turned out to be.
There you go. it's like I can host this thing. I mean, and it's only a partial calamity every week, and we're good to go.
Yeah.
All it takes is an act of God, and I get to host again. There we go. Yeah.
There you go. It's so much fun for me to listen to because I'm a fan of what we do, and I'm a fan, you know, it's especially exciting for me when I haven't already heard it and I get to hear the final production. And you know, knowing kind of what goes on to make that happen, but also just the excitement of not knowing what you guys are going to say when I listen to the show.
Oh, I mean, we don't know what we're going to say when we listen to the show.
But anyway, that's enough of the story. I spent longer than I wanted to on it. But,
sure.
You know, I feel good getting that out there, and now I have something I can go and, you know, point other friends to as well, so I don't have to keep telling that story over and over again for the rest of my life.
Just go listen to that. God.
That's right. I have it on tape now. So.
All right. So we're going to roll through some quick listener mail. Just some quick ones. We'll pick these up next week because there's always listener mail and we're always looking for more. So I'll start it off this week. Jed wrote, "Hello, RFN crew. I've been playing 3DS more lately and I have noticed while playing select titles like Donkey Kong Country, Star Fox, and Zelda that my hands start to feel uncomfortable holding the device after a few minutes of playing. I have an original 3DS and I was wondering if any of you have tried any 3DS accessory that makes it a better holding experience."
Well, I can tell you that it's not the Circle Pad Pro.
So I disagree. Well, have you held the... Are you talking about the original 3DS Circle Pad Pro?
Yes.
I actually kind of like how that feels.
I wish the grips
were bigger, though. Like, grippier, not just bulbs.
Yeah. It kind of has... for me, I think it's a little bit too bulbous for me.
It's too much like a bump and not enough like a handle.
Yeah.
So it's
more comfortable than just holding the 3DS.
Oh, definitely. And
now, John, would you say it's bulbous or Venus?
Bulbous.
Or Ivy.
Yeah. For me, that was once I got Circle Pad Pro and I got it for Resident Evil. Mm-hmm. That was all I did. I just used Circle Pad Pro even if I wasn't using a game that supported it.
Yeah.
Eventually, I got the Nyko Power Grip, which is a battery pack / grip for the thing, and it puts this nice rubberized coating on the outside of it, and that feels a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best accessory for making the 3DS feel better is the 3DS XL, to be honest.
I mean, I upgraded pretty quickly after that came out, and I just I don't feel the need for anything, you know, any extra accessories. So
we've heard pretty good things about the 2DS. I don't think any of us have had a chance to
hold
it. Yeah,
I've heard it's really nice.
You know, that may also, especially if you've and this has been a problem for me also. I find that the system is not really tall enough, and so the palms of my hand, I have pretty big hands, and the palms of my hands sort of hang off the bottom of it. You know, because I've got to get my fingers around the shoulder buttons. And so, I mean, the XL is definitely a big improvement, but the 2DS looks even taller than that since it has to carry both screens on the same plane. And I feel like, you know, as weird as that thing looks, I mean, the definitely the height of it and the fact that you can sort of fill up your entire hands with it, that's a nice benefit, I think.
In general, I've always kind of had this issue with a lot of handhelds. Yeah.
The GBASP, Jesus.
Oh, yeah.
And there's
like
the
original so Game tiny. Boy had a nice height to it, but it was so narrow that your hands were kind of cramped together.
Except I was a little kid when the original Game Boy came out.
Right.
I was 3 when I got mine. So, like, it felt huge. It felt like a monster in my hands. But as I got older, yeah, there were all kinds of dumb accessories for the original Game Boy you could get to make it grippier, especially after Pokemon came out.
Yeah.
And then shit just got crazy. But, I mean, the only system that I remember holding and really feeling like, yeah, this feels good was the original GBA. And again, I think it's because my hands weren't as big then. Mm-hmm. Like, because it's not very tall. But it just had it felt kind of like a Super Nintendo controller in your hands.
I don't know. It's so. I mean, I've owned lots of little pieces of plastic crap to make controller game systems feel better in my hands. It's always kind of a. There's never been one that I held where I thought, ah, yes, this is it.
Yeah, I mean, there's no like GameCube controller equivalent.
It's always just like,
Yeah, I mean, it's like for me the PSP feels pretty good in your hands, but that's just because it's so huge.
Yeah, it's so wide. It's like holding the handlebars on a bicycle.
It's wide, yeah. and Sony is pretty good about avoiding sharp corners on their handhelds, but because the Vita is pretty much the same shape as the PSP is, it's also very wide and it's not very tall. Mm-hmm. But at least because it is rounded, you can sort of wrap your hands around it pretty much any way you want to and find a way. Yeah, as long as the game's not using the back touch panel too much, you can usually find a way that you find is pretty comfortable.
Oh, they were just ripping off the Gizmodo. That's all.
Yeah.
Oh, but yeah, I mean, I think you could try the CirclePad Pro. You could probably get it pretty cheap right now. That the Nyko, it's the there's two Nyko back ones. There's one that screws onto the 3DS. I don't mean that one. There's one that it clips into, and that's what I'm talking about. I actually used it when I went to Europe. It lasted me enough to do the whole flight and do a day in Paris without recharging. So,
jeez. Mm-hmm. Do you know if they made an XL version of that?
I don't know. I would think they did. I mean, it's Nyko. They don't need a good reason to make dumb accessories. So apparently there is a Japanese company that produces a product that is very similar for the XL. So there's stuff out there. Okay. Maybe worth a shot. Yeah. So yeah, I think there's probably something out there that'll make it better. I mean, I've had lots of things on my 3DS at this point that make it feel better, but nothing that really knocks out the park.
I mean, the XL is the easiest, you know.
It's bigger.
I'd say go to a store and see if they have a demo unit of the XL, or maybe they just have one, like a U system behind the desk they can let you hold and try it for yourself.
Any Best Buy and Target has an XL on display.
Sure.
They all do, so you're good to go.
That's a good way to go, and if that is still not big enough, maybe the 2DS is the way to go.
Maybe you need to get smaller hands. So I'm gonna go ahead and feed this email to John.
All right, the Darkest Red wrote, "Grand Theft Auto V was presumably made with a budget of approximately $250 million. A big chunk of was marketing, but let's not get caught up in that for this question. My question to you guys is this: if you could see any game or type of game made with that kind of budget, what would it be? Don't worry about being realistic with your answers, as obviously very few studios could ever dream to work with that kind of money for a single game. Also, feel free to give an answer that isn't tied to a specific developer or franchise, such as a game in a certain genre. P.S. Still waiting for Guillaume." I'm assuming this is from what, NeoGAF?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're still waiting for you, buddy. The call's been made.
And actually, he points out in the email, he continues, I cut down a little bit. For him, it was Xenoblade, and he's kind of curious about X, the X game. And, you know, that obviously is like a big budget game.
Right. So, well, as far as NeoGAF goes, I'm a procrastinator, and I guess whenever I submit it, it's going to take like 6 to 8 weeks for years. Delivery of an account or something like that. So,
jeez, is it really that bad?
They actually engrave it on a stone tablet, and then but they don't actually use they don't use a chisel. They just let water droplets erode the text they're trying to get.
I joined NeoGAF about 10 or 11 years ago, and it was not a big deal back then.
It took like a couple days. I think
it was before it really exploded, though. For sure.
I think it's about a week usually. Which is ridiculous, but it is what it is. So for me, we're talking about just giving a game an infinite budget and seeing what happens. I mean, effectively, $250 million for a game is basically an infinite budget.
Yeah, what would $250 million pinball game look like?
It would just be they would just deliver a pinball machine to your house.
But keep in mind,
to everybody's houses,
to every house in the country. Here's your pinball machine.
Pretty much.
There would be like a pinball game, and then they would have to find something to do around it. So they would basically make GTA again.
Like, it would be, a pinball game. No, it would be like Rockstar Ping Pong, except it's like 95% of the game is just devoted from you driving to ping pong parlor to ping pong parlor.
So I think it's very hard to imagine a game that actually cost $250 million to develop, because even GTA 5 didn't cost that much to develop. A lot of it was marketing. Mm-hmm. And I think if we're being even remotely realistic here, we have to say, that would also be the case for anything we could dream up. I mean, no game has ever taken up $250 million. It's very hard to even conceive of what that would even look like.
It would basically be they have to develop the game over the course of like 4 years and then hire prostitutes for the next 2 years. And
And they're just cranking blow in the coffee room every day. I mean, that's...
You would have to do something really dumb, like have every single thing in the entire game.
Duke Nukem Forever. You'd have to do
stuff like have everything in the everything in the game voiceover.
Yeah.
You know, you would just have to completely waste money like that to make it cost that much.
Every character is played by like an A-list actor.
Well, I guess you could do something like have every single thing in the game be completely unique and not reuse anything anywhere.
But then you run into just size limits of the game. I mean, the game would be so massive.
Yeah, that's true.
I think also time in that case might be the limiting factor more than money.
Well, I mean, time and money are more or less one and the same when you game development. I mean,
if you want to outsource it to the entire world, then you know maybe have like 10,000 or 20,000 people developing the game. But
I mean, some of these big games have 200, 300, 400 developers on them. I mean,
sure.
It's kind of nuts. I want a $250 million just like world simulator. Just simulates everything.
Yeah, the thing about GTA is that it's earned its marketing budget, you know? Like it's earned its like it's worth the expense and the publisher knows it. It's hard to think that if you made a really expensive, I don't know, like space sim shooter, like Wing Commander, this genre is not popular at all anymore. If you gave it a huge marketing budget, would people even care? Would plastering the game on every bus, every, you know, like on TV all the time? I see ads all the time for GTA 5.
In the case of GTA 5, it's not even that they need to tell people what GTA is. A lot of the marketing is just about letting people know, hey, there's a new GTA. Go buy it now. And people are like, oh, yeah, I need to go buy that now.
I work with marketing people with relative regularity and corporate people who pay these marketers. Let me tell you the dirty little secret of marketing. You never know if your marketing was a worthwhile expense until you stop doing it. I mean, you really don't. You have no way of knowing if your marketing was super effective until you stop marketing. And sometimes you find when you stop, hey, we didn't need to spend that much money. And that really wasn't doing anything. But there's that built-in fear of, okay, I need to really market the shit out of this because we're heavily leveraged in it.
So I know we're talking about the part of the question that the Darkest Red asked us not to. But I think actually in the case of something like GTA, the fact that they spend so much on marketing and they get so many people buying it and talking about it actually makes the game better in a sense. It makes the game more interesting because everybody's talking about it.
It's an event, it's a big game,
so everybody has a different perspective on it. People argue about it and they compare different stories. And so I'm thinking, if I'm going to have a dream game that could use that kind of budget, I actually prefer to assume that a lot of that budget would be used for marketing, because it drives me to think, what kind of game would I dream up that would actually be better by having that many people play it? And maybe it's something like an online game, you know, like the old cliche, the Pokemon MMO or something like that. You know, you let people know that that thing exists, all of a sudden it's going to be as big as GTA. And then that would actually make that game better, because now you have so many people to play it with.
I'm thinking $250 million on a Saints Row game. Nope. No marketing expense. Just give them $250 million to make Saints Row.
You know what? Like, I don't think the game would be better.
Oh, it would be so much better.
Well, that's the thing. A lot of games would actually probably be worse if you spent that kind of money on them.
It would just be like, at this point, there's this idea of once you throw enough money at a problem, people just stop saying no to things, no matter how dumb the idea
is. Sure, I mean, how much money was wasted on Duke Nukem Forever?
Oh, we'll never know. Enough to bankrupt multiple companies.
Plenty.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's the idea of if there's no limits, you don't prune out the bad ideas.
Right.
And there's definite truth to that. I've seen it on projects where, you know, you have 10 developer resources when you really only need 8.
Kickstarter is a perfect
example. Yeah, so what do the other two do? They do stupid shit. And you're like, well, that was really pointless. Why do we do that? And it just makes the whole project feel more bloated. Now, I mean, really, my serious answer really is, if you're going to devote that kind of money, I want it to be something like a real-world simulator where things, you know, every little element affects everything else, where you're trying to map, not just, you know, map interactions of characters, but map like how them moving through the world affects like even things like foliage and animals and everything. Like,
well, yeah, like so in other words, it would be more, it's more than just content. It's actually
like
behavior, and
it's the AI, it's the simulation, it's all the really hard science-y mathematics programming stuff that really gets me just excited because that's what I am. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, you want the Matrix.
You're a robot.
You want to be go in a building and open any apartment door and open a drawer and find a cup and pick up the cup.
No, I don't want to play Heavy just Rain. Like I don't want to play Heavy Rain.
Shenmue,
I don't.
Actually.
No, I want to take a shower
and brush my teeth.
I want to be able to go into a random apartment, knock on the door, and maybe because of the specific characterization of that character and experiences they may have been having in the engine without me knowing it, they may not open the door because they're freaked out. Or, you know, maybe in the simulation, something's happened to that character before and they don't want to open the door. Even if I wasn't involved in it, I want to be able to poke this reality and just sort of see how things ripple out.
Really, James? $250 million and you would just make The Sims 5?
No, yeah, because I'm not sending them to go be in the military and then spin around and get into camouflage all day. The Sims 5 is the absolute antithesis of what I'm asking for.
Okay.
where nothing matters. You could literally kill everyone in a fire and people just move right back in. Oh, yeah, that's great. That's a great town.
This is a really interesting question, and it's very hard to answer because you immediately just go to like scaling up ideas that are already familiar, but that
right.
is
right.
almost never a way to make a game better. It might make it bigger, but you know, games, the fact that games end at some point or that you run out of things to do in them is a good thing.
Right. But if we're not realist, like the question asks, I think that there is one type of project that's unrealistic and that would probably get better if you throw money at it, and it's licensed games. Like I think I would make an actually good Back to the Future game. And like with that much money, you could have several people create several kind of, you know, time periods at the same time. And just, you know, you could travel, you know, like it would be it would kind of be GTA, but with time travel.
Yeah.
I mean, why not?
That's a really cool budget. Idea.
Go for it.
So I guess my actual idea would be, you know, here's one way you could use the money. You could develop a game with no expectation that it ever makes a return. Because
you had so much money in the first place,
you don't really care if it makes that money back. And so how about like a Wii U or even beyond that, but let's say a Wii U, really huge, fully 3D, gorgeous, like beautiful, cartoony, high def art style sequel to Earthbound that's like really grand in scale, has incredible music. They don't even have to rip off the Beatles music. They just license it, you know, and then they do like their remixes and shit, you know, and the characters have hilarious localized voices, and you know, the world is just really sprawling. It's incredibly beautiful, and you know, and that's a game they will never make their money back on it. But who cares? We got $250 million, you know.
Well, that case, I just want to make 7 Ogre Battle games. We'll be good to go.
Another
just keep
good
making
choice.
Them. Just deliver them to my house. It's fine.
You can probably make 20.
Look, like... I'll clean up the basement. Quest can come down there and just make it in the basement.
Yeah.
I'll just go down and get it when they're done.
John,
it's tough, you know, because it's that's the whole thing. It's tough to kind of think of things that are
yeah,
truly
you
new
have to
and
push
not
the limit of what is even considered feasible now.
Yeah, like that's why I was kind of getting at, you know, with James, with kind of the scale it can't just be more content,
right? It's got to be deeper. It's got to be deeper, not bigger.
Yeah, and it's kind of really hard to think about that. I would think maybe something that tied into the real world somehow. I don't know. Something that
if you die in the game, too. You die for real.
not something like that, but something that maybe, I don't know, like would require you to like travel somewhere or something like that.
Like it does like geotagging in your game.
Kind of, yeah.
Like if
that.
You want to beat the boss in Shinjuku, get on the fucking plane.
You have to actually go to Shibuya.
Wow.
Get on the plane.
Shibuya.
I like the image game. Of just like looking up and going, fuck, I'm in the wrong neighborhood, aren't I?
But like that's the thing.
I can't read any of these goddamn signs. And there's like 50 people playing the game right next to you going, we're in the wrong neighborhood, aren't we?
But that's the thing, right? So, you know, so I think of some film, like, have you ever seen, I think it's actually called The Game?
Yeah, with Michael Douglas. Yes,
Michael
David
Douglas.
Fincher,
yeah, like something like that, where it's like this kind of real life thing. So let's just say like, you're never going to make your money back, but you have $250 million to spend, and so you could. What you could do is all around the world, you could like place certain things, kind of like a geocaching kind of thing. But you know, you could place like some arena in the four corners of the earth, and people. The only people that could play it were the people that could afford to actually go there and do it.
It's John's making games for the 1%.
It is.
It's like, oh, you can't beat this boss unless you're on a yacht that's built entirely out of teak.
Hey, that's right.
Are you captaining that boat yourself? You stupid plebeian.
Well, that's the thing. Before you even do that, you have to learn how to sail. So
you have to learn how to sail.
Just keep it in perspective.
It's like, wait. Did you charter this jet or do you own it? No, you poor bastard.
Sorry, you're disqualified. Yeah, it's about the journey. That's what the game would be.
I think that,
it's
I
called
think
Bankruptcy that, Simulator 2013.
So we do have to wrap this up, but I feel like a game on this kind of scale becomes a little easier to conceive of and imagine. In the context of stuff like the Oculus Rift, or maybe like the third generation in front of that, where that technology gets really, really good. And then you start getting into weird, like virtual reality MMO space, like Ready Player One or Neuromancer or Snow Crash or something like that, you know, where like you really do kind of like jack into the Matrix. And now you're in this insane fantasy world where, you know, you're running on your like, you know, 6 degree of freedom treadmill, and you know, you're wearing your haptic gloves and shit, and like you're talking to all these other people who are all dressed up like characters from Star Wars, and you're having lightsaber battles in virtual reality.
Yeah, it's you're like, pushing that. You're pushing that sci-fi theme where it's just like, in some cases, it's almost like the ones where they just control it neurally, like they don't even do anything. Yeah. They just sit there, and they don't touch anything.
Hey man, I got to try an Oculus Rift last night. My new roommate actually has the development version, and it's really, really cool. I mean, the demos that he had were pretty clunky, but it's easy to imagine if that thing really does take off, and if they get a lot of great developers behind it, and those are very big ifs. But if that thing really, you know, I mean, the thing is, like, it's already so close to reality. It's so close to what you kind of imagined when you were a kid of what video gaming was going to turn into.
Yeah.
And the fact that you can just kind of run these weird, like, little indie developed demos off your computer on it, and it's really, really fun and really cool. That is some impressive technology. And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily going to take over all of video games, but I think it will be a part of video games. And
there's a place for it.
I think there's definitely an interest in it and a place for it. And, you know, but you can also imagine it's going to cost so much to develop really high quality games for that thing, because you really have to pay so much more attention to what is located in every dimension.
Right. You can't just block off parts of the view. Yeah.
Okay. So.
All right. Well, that's going to have to do it for this week. You know, next week we'll be back on the listener mail train, so go ahead and send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Email will also be in the show thread. Plugs. What do we have for plugs this week? What are we plugging?
So there's that new radio trivia episode.
That's right. There's a new episode of radio trivia out there with Andrew Brown. So.
That's a good one. I just listened to that today. There was last week a new episode of Famicast. Which we have every month. Hopefully you've already downloaded it, but would definitely recommend that you listen to that. They have some pretty hot coverage from TGS with the very limited amount
of coverage.
Nintendo
it's
stuff.
Sexy coverage of 3DS.
That was there. also wanted to mention we have been doing some really good stuff over on Box Office Poison. And actually, so anyone who listens to Player One podcast, you know, we had CJ and Phil from that show on the telethon last year. On the live show, and CJ, Chris Johnson from Player One Podcast, is on the latest episode of Box Office Poison. I was not on it. He was my replacement, and that's a really good episode. So you should check that out, and we might even have another special guest for this one coming up. So always recommend, if you're into movies, you know, go listen to those guys, including me.
Nice.
And that's over at Crosstalk. And then my music show is a little bit on a hiatus because I'm trying to get the data back from my computer, but hopefully that will be back soon.
Excellent. All right, so that's going to do it for us this week. Thanks all for being here, Johnny. It was great to have you back on the show, even with this confusing rulership of the hosts.
I feel so relieved to be back and to get all this stuff off my head and to be kind of back in the cycle where I feel comfortable, you know? So
yeah. It was fantastic to have you back, and I'll have to line up a guest this week. Appreciate
Welcome
that.
Back, buddy.
Thanks. All right. And I'll probably be hosting again next week, but it was
James, don't get too comfortable, buddy. No! I mean, you know, it's cool. It's cool. Yeah. You know, we let you kind of have it for a little while. Come on, man.
I asked him to host this week, actually. And yeah, I appreciate you doing it.
Come on. I'm just saying.
Fine.
Come on,
it's John. Fine. All right, John. Yeah, shut the fuck up. All right. So that's going to do it for this week. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next week. Later.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, we are doing now playing.
Wow,
let me get the script up.
I think James has infected me. I name my file GNB. New business. I'm
Gind. The Gind D. It's there a helicopter go. Chasing us.
A Gind D? Yes. What's a Gind D doing out here?
Oh, God.
That was awesome.
Anyway, let's count it down. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Make sure. Okay.
What's a Gind D doing out here?
Exactly.